And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
And hello, everybody. And it's good to be with you today. Hands-On Apologetics, you have entered into the Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. And I am your friendly host and sensei, Gary Machuda. And got a great show in store for you today. We are going to talk about relativism. Moral relativism. You know, it's part of the air that we breathe, unfortunately, especially on college campuses. You know, there's right and wrong don't exist, that morality is just a mere social convention, that there's no right and wrong absolutes. Basically, we can change what is right, what is wrong, what is moral, what is immoral. Well, to help us work through this, we're going to have Ken Hensley rejoin us in the dojo to talk about where are the real moral relativists. And it's part of our continuing series with Ken. Ken, you know, is an awesome apologist. I love the series that we're doing because he's kind of building the foundation for belief. And we run across these things all the time. So we're going to talk about relativism and how you can maybe cut through some of the nonsense that's out there in terms of, you know, that there's no right, wrong. Everything is relative. Also, we're going to go into our finding of the fallacy for today, which is misleading vividness, and also meet the early church father, St. Prosper of Aquitaine. And so a lot in store for us today. I can't wait to jump into this. And, you know, I guess before I even give out the number and everything, let's do a shout out for those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Hello, Hector. Hello, Beth, Ricky. The rest of the gang, good to see familiar names. I love the emojis. And also, I'd like to welcome you listening on radio. We appreciate you joining us on this program and also those listening on podcast via virginmostpowerfulradio.org. That is our website. And by the way, if you want to access something, maybe you can only catch part of the program and you want to find out what Ken Hensley has to say on the subject, all you have to do is just go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org website, all one word, virginmostpowerfulradio.org, and just go to our shows, scroll down to Hands-On Apologetics, and boom, you have all the shows that we've done from the very beginning to today. And, you know, just select your show. You can do all sorts of wonderful things with it. You can download it, share it, and so on. And also, you know, I want to encourage those, especially those in the live stream part of the dojo. Please, like us on Facebook, like us on YouTube, pass us around, you know, let people know about some of the great programs that you hear, because we're here to help people, and the more people we can help, the better. And as always, you are part of the program, so if you have a question for Ken Hensley on the other side of the break, give us a call, toll-free at 888-526-2151. That is 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. And also, if you want to send us an email, I know some people are a little too shy to go online or, you know, call up the show. But nevertheless, there might be something that somebody brought up that you're not really sure how to answer or even where to find the answer. Let us be your lifeline. Send us an email straight to the dojo mailbox at questions@handsonapologetics.com. Let me say that again, questions@handsonapologetics.com, all one word. By the way, Hands-On Apologetics is one of my two main websites, so if you just questions@handsonapologetics.com, shoot us an email, go straight to the dojo mailbox, and I will reply to it. By the way, my other website is GaryMachuda.com, just FYI. And, you know, I should mention this. John DeRosa was on the show the other day, and we were talking about his free ebook. And I always forget to mention this on my own show. So, like, if I don't mention it, no one will. But I also have a free ebook that you can get just by joining the dojo mailbox on handsonapologetics.com. And it's actually this book right here. Those watching on live stream will be able to see it. It is Behind the Bible, What the Bible Assumes That You Already Know. Yes, you could buy this in hardcover. But why do that when you could just sign up to the mailing list and get a free ebook instantly shot over to in your email? So you could watch, you could read it. Got lots of interesting articles I wrote on all sorts of biblical passages. Check it out, folks. And I appreciate you coming on. I promise I'm not going to spam you with a bunch of advertising. Basically, you'll just get a couple of emails. They're automated just to tell you some of the stuff that I'm involved in. And I probably should even update those of them. But, you know, it's been busy here in the dojo. I haven't had a chance to update it. But I really don't spam you. So feel free. Get a free book. All's right with the world, as we say here. All right, so let's jump into our exercises, which is finding the fallacy. Today's finding the fallacy is an interesting one. It's called misleading vividness. And this is when someone uses a small number of dramatic events to claim that something is more prevalent than is actually prevalent according to statistics. So by kind of highlighting and emphasizing a few things, it makes that thing appear to be more prevalent, more common than it really is. And in fact, you know, we see that all the time in the media. They will often focus on a couple of very high profile events and give the impression that this is an epidemic that's sweeping the nation, and you know, and we should you know, pay attention to it. When, if you look at the statistics of some of these things, you find out they're actually very, very rare. So it's a way of misleading people and, in a sense, distort the evidence so that people are fooled. It's also, by the way, known as the anecdotal fallacy, for those who care to know about that. So, you know, there's a misleading vividness. I guess there could be a flip side to this, and that is kind of a suppressing or a minimizing of events, because that way you can make something that's actually statistically prevalent appear to be small and inconsequential. I never actually saw it on the list of fallacies, but now I think about it, I think it would fit in as a nice pair for this one. So that is our finding the fallacy for today. That's the Sensei's 2 cents worth. And let's move on to meet our early church father for today. As you know, on this program, every program we bring up an early church father just so you know who they are, what they did, when they lived, because early church fathers, early Christian writings are very important for defending the faith. So we should have a good grasp of church history and some of the movers and shakers, if you will, of our history. And today's early church father is Prosper of Aquitaine. Not very much is known about St. Prosper, and even that's even gleaning from his own writings. I mean, we don't know a lot. We know that he was a monk in Marseille, France, although he was not in clerical orders. He was a friend of St. Hilary of Poitiers, and he wrote a letter, which is included in the letters of Augustine. But unlike Hilary, he had no personal acquaintance with Augustine, which is kind of interesting because he is very influenced by him. Soon after Augustine's death in August of AD 430, Prosper and Hilary went in person to Rome, where they asked Pope Celestine I to issue a formal condemnation of semi-Pelagianism. We talked about semi-Pelagianism before on this program. It's more or less a denial of original sin, kind of like that we can do good and God's grace kind of helps out, but really it's us who do it. The Pope did issue a letter to the bishops of Gaul. By the way, Gaul is an old name for France, so what is today modern France, generally commending Augustine, but he did not outright condemn semi-Pelagianism, but only enjoyed a silence among the disputed points. So beginning around 432, Prosper himself commenced to drift away from the strictest interpretations of Augustinian theology. And he did continue to see, however, that the root of Pelagian and semi-Pelagian errors is in the teaching that is central to them, namely the thesis that grace is given to men according to their merits. When Pope St. Leo the Great became Bishop of Rome in 440 AD, Prosper came down again from Gaul and was given a post in the papal chancery. And according to Genetus of Marseille, it was Prosper who drafted certain letters of Pope Leo against another two other heresies, Eutychianism and Monophysism. And Eutychianism is a heresy concerning the Trinity, and Monophysism is a heresy concerning Christ, that Christ only had one nature, a kind of mixed nature of divine and human natures. So he was responsible for a few of these letters that were issued by Pope Leo. Prosper cannot be found after 455 AD. In other words, the record that we have of him and his writings just stop. So most scholars believe that the reason for that is that he died around 455. You know, brilliant deduction, isn't it? So that is our Meet the Early Church Father for today. That is St. Prosper of Aquitaine. And by the way, he's very influential, like I said, in those, especially the heresy of Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism. The church sometimes quotes from him in that regard. He has some very beautiful writings. And if you want to see some quotes, you could go to this one of my favorite little-known councils, the Council of Second Orange. Look at the canons and decrees. You'll find his influence there. Coming up on the other side of the break, Master Apologist Ken Hensley joins us to talk about relativism and how to disarm it. So stay tuned, everybody. It's going to be a lot of fun.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. We are joined with a fellow that's been here at the dojo a number of times as part of our series, and that is Kenneth Hensley, who's a nationally known Catholic teacher and author who has converted to Catholicism in 1997. He's worked extensively in the field of apologetics and has been interviewed numerous times on Catholic radio, television, and invited to many Catholic conferences across the country. In fact, we just had Ken speak here in Michigan not too long ago at the Midwest Apologetics Conference. He specializes on a range of subjects from natural, Christian, and Catholic apologetics. He also is skilled in the art of what's called evidentialist and presuppositional apologetics. He works as the online resource and pastoral care coordinator for Coming Home Network. And you can find out all the great stuff that Ken does at his website, www.kennethhensley.com. Let me say that again, www.kennethhensley.com. And Ken, welcome to Hands On Apologetics.
Your voice.
It's good to hear you. We have an interesting topic for today because this is something that we're kind of swimming in here in America, is moral relativism. Maybe we can start by explaining a little bit, what is moral relativism?
Well, first of all, did you get my email I sent you about an hour ago?
I did.
I sent an email saying that we would. Oh, okay, good. I just want to make sure that we don't end up running ahead to the material for next month.
I'll follow your lead.
Yeah, I looked back over my material and I just realized there's plenty to talk about, you know, if we really want to convey it well and not get into Sam Harris and Peter Singer and all these guys, you know, this week. We'll do that next time, okay?
Okay.
Moral relativism, well, its essential meaning is simply that morals are relative, that is, moral standards are relative from one person to another or from one society to another, or to put it the other way around, that there is no such thing. Moral relativism teaches that there is no such thing as a moral law that exists in this universe of ours. Morals are decided from person to person or society to society.
Right. Is it kind of like a parallel with, a truth for you, truth for me? It's like I have my morality, mm-hmm. you have yours.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing. In fact, moral relativism has been around a long time, but the relativism of truth is something that it's a deeper issue even. The one we call moral relativism, the other we call epistemological relativism, to use a big philosophical word. But the idea that truth itself is relative, you know, is something that's very popular now, but it descends us into an even deeper insanity. And we'll get to that when we get to the lesson on laws of logic and the mind and whatnot, but we're talking about morals today.
Okay.
The paper that I wrote, or the article that I wrote that I titled, "Where Are the Real Moral Relativists?" That's what I want to talk about today. Mm-hmm. Where are the real moral relativists? And if I could, let me tell the little story that I begin that with, because it's a good illustration of moral relativism to support the answer I just gave to your question. Way back in junior college, my wife and I, Tina and I, we weren't married at the time. We were sitting in psychology class and we had an atheist professor. And I remember this so clearly because it was a sort of a turning on the lights moment in my mind. He comes into class one day and there are probably 100 people in this lecture hall. And he just launches into a lecture on morality. And he begins by saying, "There is no such thing as moral law. Right and wrong do not exist." That's how he began. And he said, morals are relative from, you know, person to person, from society to society. And he said there are some Eskimo tribes that believe that when a person is old, like, you know, Ken Hensley, who turns 65 in 1 week. How old are you, Gary?
I'm around 50.
I thought you were going
to
say
I try not to keep track. Tell you the truth.
But, he said when people get old in some of these Eskimo societies, they just, take grandma and grandpa and put them on a block of ice and just boot them out into the Bering Straits, basically. They're not useful anymore. And of course, he told that, he gave that illustration with an air of, and who's to judge? I mean, who's to decide? Because after all, right and wrong don't exist, objectively don't exist. They're relative from person to person, society to society. Well, I remember sitting in that lecture hall and looking around the room, and I'm seeing all these students just sort of furiously scribbling down their notes. And I was just stunned. I was just thinking, this guy has essentially walked into the room and just announced that God doesn't exist, you know?
Yeah.
Because if God exists, then obviously a moral law could exist.
Right.
And he's just announced as though it were an obvious fact that moral law doesn't exist. And, you know, no one seems to notice. Everyone's just taking notes as though he said something that was scientifically true or common sense or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I raised my hand and I brought up the Hitler thing, okay? I raised my hand and I said, you know, if what you just said is true, then I guess we can't really say that what Hitler did was wrong, can we? I mean, the best we can say is that we don't like it, or that we, you know, that we all agree that it's no good, but we can't really say it was wrong in the sense of him violating any law. And this teacher, he literally started to turn red. I almost felt bad for him right away because he started to turn red. He started to kind of walk backwards into the corner of the lecture hall. I mean, really moving backwards a couple
wow.
of steps. He stood there. He stumbled around for about 10 seconds, and then he said this. He said, well, I guess there are some things that we agree on enough that it kind of really becomes wrong.
Wow.
How do you respond to that, Gary?
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is that I wonder if it was your question that stunned him or the fact that somebody piped up and actually challenged him on this point.
Yeah, you know, I guess I don't know. I mean, yeah, you're right. Maybe he just thought what I'm saying is so basic that,
yeah.
you know, I'll just get it out quickly and everybody can agree and then we'll move on to something more important.
Right.
You know, I don't really know, you know, but you know, the point is,
yeah.
I've never met a person who really did not believe in the existence of objective moral law.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy is an example. This guy, because he was an atheist, you know, the logical conclusion for him was that moral law doesn't exist. I mean, most atheists don't believe that material exists, you know, particles out there bouncing around. And then also, for some reason, some unknown reason, a moral law just exists, like floating out in space or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, most atheists recognize that moral law doesn't exist in a materialist universe. And so, you know, he had worked out the logic of this, and he thought he had a good illustration, you know, and, you know, how can we judge the, you know, the Eskimos and whatnot. But when someone, you know, like really pressed him on it, then he was just stuck, you know, he didn't know what
yeah.
to say.
Right. Yeah. That's how funny. So that was the best he could do, huh? Was that, well, I guess,
well,
you know, the majority would say.
Yeah, at least on his feet, that was the best he could do, you know. And
yeah.
Anyway, what that brings me to, though, is, you know, we'll develop this in more detail. What it brings me to, though, is what C.S. Lewis wrote, you know, his great book, Mere Christianity. He begins that book by trying to establish the fact that a moral law exists and that everyone believes in a moral law. And I'm sure you've read it. It's a great book. And sort of bouncing off C.S. Lewis's argument, or really just repeating his argument in different words, that's what I would say is that some of us may say that we believe that morality is truly relative from person to person or culture to culture, but no one really believes it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what C.S. Lewis does at the beginning of Mere Christianity is he points out that if you just listen to people talking, you will understand that everybody just naturally believes in right and wrong. You know, when you, like a lady steps in front of me in the line at the grocery store checkout counter, if I were to say to her, excuse me, but I was in the line before you, you can imagine a number of responses that she might give to that. She might say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you and step behind me. Mm-hmm. Or she might say, I'm sorry, but my father's ill and I'm in a big hurry this morning. Is it okay if I stand in front of you? Or she might say, you know, please, your shopping cart is full and I only have one or two items. Is it okay with you? But the one thing that you will never hear her say is, you were in line ahead of me, so what? Morality is relative. My moral standards are different than yours. Better luck next time.
Right.
You know, in the way that we speak commonly, you know, I think C.S. Lewis uses illustrations like he says, you know, we say to each other, you know, hey, I gave you a piece of my orange. Why don't you give me a piece of yours? Or you can hear kids talking and they'll say that this isn't fair. Or we talk about justice and we think things are unfair or unjust or whatnot. We evidence all day long that we believe that such a thing as a moral law exists, or that right and wrong is something that actually exists. You follow?
Yeah, yeah. Well, couldn't somebody say, well, oh, sure, but that's just being polite. You know, we're raised to be polite. And so to step in front of somebody in the line, you know, that's against the social convention of politeness. It's not a violation of some invisible law. Like, could you flush that a little bit?
Well, yeah, they could say that. Sure. I mean, so someone could say anything.
Right.
They could say this is just a convention. There is nothing right or wrong about it. But then again, if you just press it a little bit further, if you say, well, is it just a convention that we don't rape people?
Yeah.
Is it just a convention that we don't lie? Or is it just a convention that we don't steal? You know, I think of a lot of illustrations of, you know, I've got my funny professor illustrations that a professor teaching moral relativism, and, you know, he may say morals are relative, but try cheating on his test on moral relativism.
Yeah, good point.
And the guy suddenly becomes a moral absolutist. Or if you go and you steal the stereo out of his car, I guess people don't even have stereos anymore in their car, but they used to. If you steal the stereo out of his car, he suddenly becomes a moral absolutist and he says, this is wrong. And if you say to him, well, hold on, you've been telling me all semester that there's no such thing as right and wrong, that this is just convention. And, you know, morals are relative from person to person. Well, I don't have exactly the same standards you have. And I need a stereo, so see you later.
Yeah. So, yeah, I remember my senior, William Smith, blessed memory, he said, if you ever have a teacher who says all morals are relative, take the wallet out of their purse. And he said, all of a sudden you'll see morality, you know, present itself. Oh, I hear the music coming on. We're talking with Kenneth Hensley about moral relativism, and it's a fun discussion. If you want to join us, give us a call, 888-526-2151. And the discussion continues right after this break, so stay tuned, everyone.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. you can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. We are talking with Kenneth Hensley about moral relativism and great discussion. You know, Ken, I think, let me know what you think about this, but you could go to a toddler who's playing with a ball, take the ball away and start playing with yourself, and he'll express himself. Right, he will be not happy.
Yes,
because innately, it's almost like he has a sense that an injustice occurred. But this is way before any enculturation or like value impressions given on him.
Yes, entirely. And of course, our answer is that God has created him in His image and likeness. God does exist. God is a moral being. God has created us to be reflectors of His being, and we are in His image and likeness. And therefore, the fact that a moral law exists is it's a fact that a moral law exists, and it's written into our very souls, and so we know it. And I would say this is evidence of it, that even a child of 2 or 3 senses injustice.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
They don't have a refined moral sense, and they may turn around and take the toy from their younger brother, and walk away with it. But because they've inherited sin as well as the image of God, and
right.
A sense of what is right and wrong. But anyway, the point that I wanted to begin with is simply to say that this idea that morality is relative from person to person is popular, and people will say it, but no one really lives as though it's true, and I would say no one really believes it. Because if you said to me, truly, that morality is personal and that you have your morality and I have mine, then logically, you can't say anything. If I pull up my U-Haul truck in front of your house tomorrow and start loading your furniture into my truck.
That's true.
You can say you don't like it. You can say you're unhappy, or you can just use force, to take me down. But it would be irrational for you to say that what I'm doing is wrong, quote unquote. And the professor of moral relativism doesn't know what to say if I cheat on his test on moral relativism. Or if he gives me a C on the test and then I walk into his office the next day and put a gun against his head and say, change that to an A. He can say he doesn't like it again. And that's really my point, that to say that morality is relative from person to person ultimately reduces down to saying that morality is nothing, that right and wrong are nothing more than words that you and I use to describe what we like and what we don't like.
Right.
That everything is just personal preference.
Yeah.
And so what people will normally do is they'll try to strengthen their position by saying, I'm not saying that literally every person just decides for himself what is right and wrong. I don't mean that. But cultures, that people, morality is relative from culture to culture. Society to society. Certain societies develop, like those Eskimos, they develop their culture. And when the old folks are not useful to society anymore, they put them out on a block of ice. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's their way. And I remember when I first read the book, you ever heard the book called The Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom? It came out about 25 years ago, and it was kind of a big hit. He was a professor, and he wrote at the time, he was bemoaning the fact that on college campuses, he said, everyone is a relativist now. And he said, when people come into my classroom, I can assume that they believe that morality is relative. And even if I give them an extreme example, like I say, what do you think about the tradition in rural India, at least in the older days, it still occurs some now, but not very much. The tradition of that when a man dies, his wife is burned alive on his funeral pyre. Mm-hmm. When they go to burn his body, they just throw her on top and she dies. And then, what do you think about that? And he said most of the students in the class could not bring them to say that that was wrong. That there was a moral problem with it.
Yeah.
So that's where that's a position that people will take and that they think is a stronger position. But again, if you press on that position, Gary, well, this is what you get. If it really is true that morality is relative from society to society, then it wouldn't be rational to go around talking about one society as being less moral than another, would it?
No, not at all.
It wouldn't make any sense to say that the morality of ISIS is worse than the morality of, Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
Or that the morality of Orthodox Judaism is any better than the morality of the mafia. You know, how can you distinguish them? Because as soon as you start saying that one society's morality is better than another's, then you're appealing again to some kind of a law. You're appealing to something that you think is superior to both of those cultures and by which you can judge them. In other words, you're rejecting your very premise that it's all more. I mean, that it's all relative.
Yeah. Yeah, that certainly accounts for this oppressive egalitarianism that we live in, that nothing is better than anything else. Everything's equal. And, for you to make truth claims or to say something is right or wrong, that you're imposing your beliefs on others and therefore, you are filled up with pride whatever.
And even that is done in a completely inconsistent, in fact, in a contradictory way. I think that G.K. Chesterton said one time, he said Christianity and Buddhism are a lot alike, especially Buddhism. Okay,
I love that quote.
yeah. Christianity and Buddhism are a lot alike, especially Buddhism. I mean, in other words, the very people that would say that, oh, you're imposing your morality on me, are saying it is wrong of you to impose your morality on me. Or they're the same ones that will turn around and say, oh, my God, but Trump?
Right.
You know? So, I mean... They hold that all kinds of things are wrong.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there is that odd schizophrenia, isn't it? That on one hand, they preach and maybe even try to live kind of like different strokes for different folks, but yeah, when you kind of go beneath the surface, all of a sudden they become absolutist and you can't do that, or this person is definitely wrong.
Right. Yeah, and and again, there's no way to escape it because there is a moral law.
Yeah.
So, it's these are all attempts to follow out logically a worldview. You know, the attempt of, well, morality is relative from person to person, but it doesn't really work. People are going to say it, but they can't really live according to it without their life just, falling apart. And then on the societal level, it's the same thing. You can say, well, morality is relative from society to society. But, when Hitler starts to attack, Czechoslovakia and Austria and all that, no one sits back and says, well, his society is just different than ours. You know, he's got different conventions than we have. Yeah. Who are we to judge?
Right.
No one says that. Instead, it's like, well, but they're wrong. And the most liberal, or at least a person who thinks that they're liberally minded, the one you're describing, the most liberally minded different strokes for different folks, who are we to impose on morality, typically have very, very strong moral views about all kinds of things.
Right.
And they want the law to support their moral views.
Yeah.
It's morally wrong to impose yours on them and all that. And I think you said something really sharp when you said that they are like relativists who are absolutists at the same time.
Yeah,
because I think that's exactly what happens. You know, because atheists are the image and likeness of God, because they know, I would say, to their very bones that right and wrong are real, that they exist, And so even though they may say that morality is relative, they can't live as though morality is relative. And you can point that out in a million different ways. In order for their lives to not descend into some kind of complete chaos, they actually have to live as though an objective moral law existed. And that's what, you know, the illustrations of the ethics professor and whatnot all tell us. You can say something, but you can't really live according to it. I mean, imagine how your life would collapse if you really did. If you really did say, well, let's say you have a family. I don't know, how many children do you have?
Three. I got that one right. Three.
Okay. You don't remember how old you are, but.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the reason. It's because I have three teenagers. I don't even know how old I am.
Well, imagine if you said to your wife and to your kids, hey, look, morality is relative, and all five of us are going to develop our own standards. And I want us all to live according to our own standards too, you know.
Right.
So, you know, if one of your kids is just beating the other one half to death in the corner of the room, that instead of stopping them or telling them the guy who's beating up the other one that it's wrong, you just do values clarification. You just say, so what exactly is the value that you are acting out here? And he says, well, you know, the value that I've imbibed is the survival of the fittest. I was reading this book by Darwin, and he says this: the fittest survive. And you know, I want the species to evolve, and so my brother is weaker than I am, and I'm taking him out.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a funny story. Tina and I, we didn't really have the guts to do this, but we had this idea when we were in college together that we were going to go into biology class, and she was going to go in first. And she was going to go sit in the front row, and I was going to come sauntering in late to class, and I was going to walk down the aisle and grab her by the hair and throw her on the floor, you know, and take a seat. And when the entire room just rose up in indignation against the evil, you know, then I was going to, this is if I had the courage to do it, but I didn't. then I was going to look around, you know, befuddled and say, I don't understand. You've been teaching us that, you know, I mean, we just evolved from slime, and, you know, there's no moral law, and the fittest survive. And I've read some studies that show that people who sit in the front of the class do better than those who sit in the back. And she's obviously smaller and weaker than I am. Don't you want the species to evolve? See how they responded.
Yeah, I wonder what they would say. Yeah, although, the sheer shock of that happening, I don't know. They would probably be stupefied and not have anything to say. But, you know, you're right, though. It, as an idea, you know, moral relativism seems to be workable. But when it comes down to brass tacks, actually living it out, it can't be. It's just pure chaos. Well, I hear the music coming up. It's time for our next break. Oh. We're talking with Kenneth Hensley about moral relativism and how to dismantle it. Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. I'm Gary Machuda. We're talking with Ken Hensley about moral relativism. And Ken, I want to start, I just want to share a story because it's sort of like what you were thinking of doing, although a bit different. I was listening to an interview with Steve Martin. And when he was on the set of Parenthood, when they're filming, him and some of the little kids that played as children had this routine that they came up with, where on the set, whenever they see him, they would run towards him and yell, "Steve, Steve," and be all smiles. And when they came near him, he would take his hand, put it on the forehead, and push him to the floor and just keep walking. And you know, the humor behind that is, it's kind of like a horrible injustice, right? He could have said, "Well, I'm stronger than they are. My time is money." He could have gave all sorts of rationalization why he didn't need to spend even a second with these kids. But it's kind of, it reminds me of the exercise that we were just talking about.
Well, the Marquis de Sade, from whose name we get the word sadism, the Marquis de Sade famously said, "Nature has made women weaker than men. Men can do anything they want to them." Hmm. So, his morality was strictly based on a raw materialist, atheist, evolutionary kind of point of view. Yeah. And, and his logic would have been, "Hey, look, I've come from nowhere. I'm here on the earth for just a short period of time, 50, 60, 70, 80 years, and then I'm gone forever. I'm going to do whatever I want."
Right.
I'm an accident of an accidental universe in a meaningless universe, and I'm going to do what I want. And the only law that I see is the law of nature, that nature is red in tooth and claw. Yeah. And women are weaker. I'm going to do whatever I want. And so he was famous for torturing women and whatnot. And like I said, we get the word Satan from him. But have you ever seen the movie Rope by Alfred Hitchcock's movie Rope?
No, I haven't.
Well, if you want to watch, once in a while you run into a movie that is philosophically interesting. Mm-hmm. And Rope is one of those. It stars Jimmy Stewart. And it's one of those great movies that is entirely dialogue. It's all filmed in one room. It's not like a million cuts and a bunch of adventure and a bunch of action and whatnot. It's dialogue. And it's so interesting. What it's about, though, is exactly what we're talking about. It's about Jimmy Stewart is the prep school teacher or professor. And it's about two of his students. Their professor has been teaching a Nietzschean view of the universe, Friedrich Nietzsche, the father of modern atheism. And he had been teaching his class that that some people are superior to others, and that in an atheist universe where moral absolutes don't exist, the superior can do what they like with the inferior. And that's what he's been teaching them. Well, these two students who have been buying into this worldview in a serious way, they decide as a purely intellectual exercise to take a student from their school that they viewed as being inferior and kill him,
wow,
murder him. And then this is their plan. They're going to murder the guy, and they do it. And they stuff his body into a chest, and they invite their professor over for a dinner party. And they also invite in the parents of the boy that they've murdered, the fiance of the boy they've murdered, a couple of his relatives and a couple of his friends, and they invite them over for a dinner party, and they use the chest that his body is in as a buffet table.
Wow.
Put the food and the drinks and whatnot. And anyway, they invite them over. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, I heard a little noise in my phone, and I thought something was happening. But they invite the people over, and then because they're so excited by what they've done, and they think that their professor is going to be so impressed with how consistently they've actually acted out the worldview that he's been teaching them in the class, they throughout the party they start dropping little hints that only he would understand as to what they've done. Well, at the end of the movie, the families have gone home, the fiance's gone home, father and mother have gone home, and the professor comes back into the room because he realizes what's up. Anyway, he goes over, and at a certain point, he opens up the chest, and he sees the boy's body in the chest, and he's absolutely horrified. He's mortified by their insistence that what they have done was inspired by him, because they begin to say, well, but professor, you taught us. This is what you taught us, and we have the courage to actually act out, you know, Nietzsche's idea of the Superman. You know, we're acting out the fact that we are superior and this guy's weaker and we've done what we wanted to him, just the things you've been teaching us. And anyway, in the movie, Jimmy Stewart turns white and he cries out, basically, in essence, he cries out, but those were just ideas.
Hmm. Wow.
And this is exactly the thing that you're talking about. On the level of ideas, you can say that right and wrong don't exist. And you have to say it if you're an atheist. Mm-hmm. You have to say that a law of morality doesn't really exist, that it's something that either has just evolved in us, or it's something that is relative from culture to culture, person to person, or we just figure it out for ourselves, or we all try to agree on this or that, or we use sort of a democracy view of deciding what's right and wrong, you know, where I like right. to say, you know, on Monday, 51% of the population said that abortion was wrong, and so it became wrong, but on Tuesday, another poll showed that 51% now think abortion is right, and so now it's right.
Yeah, right.
You can prop up a lot of standards, and when we talk next month, that's kind of what we're going to go into more is like, well, what kind of standards can you create out of thin air if you're an atheist and you don't believe that right and wrong exist? And that's what we're going to talk about. But the point that I'm just making here today is simply that there are no relativists really. Even though relativism is demanded by the atheist worldview, there really are no relativists.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, what a powerful example.
If I could, I want to repeat one point that I made last time, you know, for some who may be listening, and that is that I'm not presenting this as a proof of God's existence.
Right.
I'm simply saying that based on God's existence, moral law makes sense. If God exists, then moral law makes sense. And I believe that moral law is evident in the world, and it's evident in us because we're made in the image and likeness of God. And I'm simply saying that if you want to be an atheist and a materialist, then you have to face the fact that you have no basis for telling anyone that what they're doing is wrong or right.
Yeah.
And that an atheist just needs to live with that.
Right. So it's a matter of coherence then, that the theistic view coheres with our experience, even in a moral realm, where with atheism you have an incoherence.
Yes, I think that's a good way of saying it. This is a series that we're going to be talking through. And a month ago, when we met, or 3 weeks ago, we talked about the idea of human value, right? Mm-hmm. The value and worth of human beings, and we wound up in the same place. Just realizing that if you believe in God and our creation and the image and likeness of God, then it is rational for you to believe that human beings have a special, unique value, that equal value should apply to every human being, and so forth. But if you're an atheist and a materialist, then you have no basis for saying that human beings have intrinsic value above anything else, above a cockroach, a worm, a dirt clod. So, yeah, we're talking about coherence, and the argument that I'm making when I talk to an atheist is simply to try and get the atheist, see, because I believe the atheist is made in the image and likeness of God, and so the atheist responds to the Christian worldview in a sense, because it's written into his soul. It's written into his soul that human beings have value, and he knows that. And he basically lives, unless he's become so hard-hearted that he's like, you know, a member of ISIS or something. He lives as though human beings have innate value. And yet, and so what I want to do is just point out the fact that if he's an atheist, his worldview doesn't support that. That his worldview, in fact, contradicts that. That he's, in a sense, having to reject his worldview and the logical implications of it and take on, essentially, a Christian worldview in order to live. So I'm basically pointing to evidences that, exist within him or her that their worldview doesn't make sense, doesn't cohere with even how they feel. And so today we've started to talk about morality, and that's just another illustration, really. You know, whereas you and I have grounds for believing that moral law exists, an atheist has no grounds.
Right. Yeah, very good.
To live as though moral law exists.
Very good. Well, I'm going to have to check out the movie The Rope. I have a feeling that it's probably wasn't voted the feel-good movie of the year when it came out. But, you know, kind of to illustrate your point, and I'd like to hear your thoughts. We only have maybe a minute or so. But, you know, when Jimmy Stewart says, but those are just ideas, can you imagine a math teacher say, you know, hey, professor, you know, the students come and say, professor, look, we did all these math problems. And he says, no, those were just ideas. It's like, no, there's a coherence there between reality and practice and also an idea where there's like a complete incoherence, you know, in terms of morality.
Yeah, and the same thing with, you know, with math, the same thing with science, the same thing with history, the same thing with any subject.
Yeah.
You expect there to be a coherence. You don't expect someone to teach you something, and then when you actually live it out, say, well, hold on. you know, essentially what Jimmy Stewart is saying there is, you know, I was just playing with ideas that I think are like fun and audacious, but I don't mean they're true.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Yeah, I'll have to check it out. Very good.
Well, yeah, it's not a feel good movie. You know, it's sort of like Glengarry Glen Ross or something. It's like a depressing or Death of a Salesman or something. It's more on the depressing side. But the thing that makes it interesting is to have a movie that is about philosophy.
Yeah,
which you
don't
get that often.
Right.
You know, at least
very
the movies I've seen recently, not too often.
Well, very good. Okay, so where can people go to get your all the stuff that you do?
Well, I work for the Coming Home Network, and so I'm blogging on a regular basis for the Coming Home Network, and you could go to the Coming Home Network's website, and on the blog page there are some things that I'm doing. But if someone wanted to purchase recorded talks, they should go to the website you mentioned, KennethHensley.com.
Oh,
KennethHensley.com. There's a page there where you can download. Very inexpensively, you can download MP3 talks on a bunch of things that I've done in the past.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Ken, for coming on the show.
Thank you, and we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. That was Ken Hensley, ladies and gentlemen. Great stuff. Lots of fun. It's always fun to talk to Ken, and especially in the area of relativism. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to have a special edition of Hands-On Apologetics. Bobby Hensley is going to come into the studio. And we're going to have Jimmy Akin on the line. They're going to discuss Batman, of all things, saint, superhero, or neither. So that should be a very fascinating show. Also, coming up next, the dynamic duo of Catholic Talk Radio, the Terry and Jesse Show. And it's great to be with you. Thank you so much for listening to the program. I appreciate it. Got to shut down the Midwest Command Center and turn off the lights here in the dojo. I hope everybody has a wonderful and blessed day. And I'll talk to you tomorrow, God willing. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app, I know how listening to Catholic Audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.